Broadcasting worldwide on internet radio.
Refreshing takes on legal strategies.
Straightforward answers to difficult tax questions.
Independent ideas on building wealth. The Refresher Wealth Show with Mark Kohler and Matt Sorensen.
Previously recorded with Mark as the host of The Mark Kohler Show.
Enjoy this fresh take on strategies to better live the American dream.
Hi, everybody. This is Jerem Bergeson. I am in for Mark Kohler today. Mark has got a speaking engagement up in Salt Lake City, and so he's not available to do the radio show, but he's left it in my very capable hands. Anyway, my name's Jerem Bergeson. I am an attorney with KKOS Lawyers in the Cedar City office, kind of run our office here, obviously work with Mark on legal strategies for entrepreneurs and business owners, and I'm excited to be on the show today. I think we've got an interesting topic. I think I'm going to probably be on the show most of the time today, so there won't be, I don't think there's going to be any guests. There may be. I've got one call out to somebody. I've got one call out to somebody to perhaps come in later in the show. I don't know if he will be able to do that or not, but if not, I'm going to be talking with you about intellectual property, how to have it for your business, how to protect your name of your product or your business itself. That's what we're going to be talking about. We'll be going through various kinds of intellectual property and that sort of thing. So hopefully you'll stay awake. I know that's a big thing on this radio show. Mark wants to make sure that everybody's awake, and so I don't put anybody to sleep. So I'm going to try not to do that, but obviously you never know. I do want to go through some of the upcoming live events that were sent out on the newsletter. Hopefully everybody who's listening to the show is on the newsletter. If you're not, you can email me. And let me go ahead and throw out my email address anyway, because I do want questions. If you've got any questions, you can either put them on the chat line about this subject. You can email your questions to me about trademarks, copyrights, patents, intellectual property to my email address, which is Jerem, J-A-R-O-M, as in Mary, at kkoslawyers.com. So I'm throwing out that email address. Please feel free to send me questions about this topic. Anyway, excited to try to answer a few of those. And if I can't answer them on the show, I'll be certainly upfront with you about whether I can answer it, and I'll get back to you later on that. But let me also, real quickly, go through those upcoming live events. Right now, actually in about an hour and a half, if you're in Salt Lake City, Mark is going to be speaking with the title Tax and Legal Strategies Every Realtor Should Know. It's sponsored by Keller Williams. It is in Salt Lake this afternoon. He's preparing for that. He may even still be traveling to that event. So hence the reason you're getting me on the show today. Coming up on August 12th in Riverside, California, Mark's going to be doing a bookkeeping basics and introduction to QuickBooks, sponsored by New Wealth Advisors, from 7 to 9:30 p.m. on the 12th. So if you're in the Riverside, California area or Southern California, you can catch Mark on August 12th. And then later that week on Saturday, August 16th, Mark's going to be in Salt Lake City for Tax and Legal Strategies for Real Estate Investors, sponsored by Renatus. So he's going to be speaking for to the Renatus community on August 16th. And I can't think of a better way. That's going to be Saturday from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. I can't think of a better way to spend a non-college football Saturday than with Mark, learning tax and legal strategies for real estate investors. Let's bring on, we've got a couple tipsters. Generally, I'm one of these tipsters bringing on a tax or legal tip. However, this week, since I'm hosting, we've got some other folks. I think we'll go with first Liddell. Liddell is on the line. He's one of the partners at Kohler & Ayer. Liddell Ayer, obviously. His name's on the accounting firm, so he's got a lot of experience and knowledge behind him, and we're excited to have him on the show. How are you, Liddell?
Good. How are you, Jerem? Thanks for having me on.
Not a problem at all. Glad to have you on. Glad you could take some time. Why don't you let us know what your tax tip would be for the day?
All right. Well, I got a couple of things quickly. I wanted to kind of give a couple of mid-year tax moves, tax strategy type things that people could be looking for, and then I'll go into kind of more of the meat of what my tax tip was today. A couple of things to keep in mind was in regards to capital losses, look at your stock portfolio and see maybe what needs to be cleared out of there. It's time to cull some of those old stocks out of there, some that are going to always be losses, you know, with the stock market doing so well over the last couple of years.
Yeah.
Not every stock does really well, so there's going to be some losses in there. So that's what I was just going to mention, is maybe take a look at those and harvest those capital losses this year to go against your capital gains. So that's one of the tips for today. The other one is take a look at your 401k contributions, making sure that you're going to be able to max that out. That limit is $17,500 for 2014. Mm-hmm. And if you're age 50 or older, it's $23,000. So if you got some extra money or squeeze some extra money out of your paycheck and try to get those contributions into your 401k all the way up there. The other thing I was going to mention, make sure you're paying your estimated tax payments quarterly, especially if you're self-employed or if you have a lot of other investments that kick off income. But the main part of my tax tip today happened to me kind of yesterday. I was talking to a client, and they were mentioning, well, what about all these repairs I did last year? Were they out on my tax return? You know, that spent $40,000+ in so-called repairs, and they were wondering why they weren't being deducted. They'd bought a rental property and basically rehabbed it, and they're wondering, why didn't I get a tax deduction for all those repairs? They were repairs. And so I kind of had to explain to them the difference between a repair and a capital improvement. Mm-hmm. And so I just wanted to point out a couple of things in regards to that. When we talk about capital improvements, we're meaning we're going to capitalize them and we're going to depreciate them. You know, they can be depreciated over 5 years, 15 years, 27 and a half years, if it's residential rental, or if it's commercial, all the way up to 39 years. Okay. So what clients or people out there should be doing is making sure you're keeping track of that, making sure you're keeping good records of the receipts and everything you're doing on those on those improvements. And so I want to throw out about three items on each one. If it's considered capital, which means it needs to be depreciated, there's kind of three things we look at. One is, did it put the property in a better operating condition? Two, did it restore the property to a like-new condition? Or, you know, was it an upgrade or a modification to the property? Did you add a garage to it? Did you add something more significant? And one of the main things is, did it enhance the value of the property or extend the useful life? So that's mm-hmm. more of a capital type thing in nature. Now, when you talk about repairs could be just fixing a tile floor or fixing a hole in the wall or painting or stuff like that, which a repair is more of keeping the property in good, efficient operating condition, or mm-hmm. restoring it to its previous condition, or just kind of protecting the property through routine maintenance. And so I had to go all through this with a client yesterday and kind of explain the differences. And we kind of worked through it, and, well, some of it's repairs, and some of it we really have to depreciate. You know, if you go in and re-site a whole house and put in some new insulation in and new siding and new waterproof barrier, then we're probably going to need to capitalize that and depreciate that over time. So I just want the clients out there that as you're buying rental properties, as you're buying fixer-uppers, those kind of things, kind of be aware that maybe all the money you're spending isn't necessarily going to be an immediate tax deduction and right. have to be done over time. So there's my tax tip for today.
All right, that's a great one. And so working with K&E or you know the client's CPA, whoever it may be, is you're going to be able to help walk them through the difference and make sure that in an audit that they're not calling something repairs when they really should have been capital improvements or vice versa, correct?
Right. And that's why it's really important to kind of document what you're doing, keeping receipts for what you're doing,
yeah.
and probably even pictures. You know, what was the condition of it before? Are you just kind of keeping it in its normal operating condition, or are you throwing a whole new roof on and putting new boards and new, you know, paper on there and new asphalt shingles? You might have redone the whole roof rather than just repaired it. So make sure you're keeping good records of what you are doing when you're fixing up a rental property.
That makes a lot of sense. Well, anything else, Liddell?
No, that's it for today. Can't give all my knowledge out at once.
That's right. Well, we appreciate you coming on. Thanks a bunch.
Okay, thanks, Jerome.
Thanks. All right, so that's Liddell Ayer of Kohler & Ayer CPAs. He's Mark's partner on the accounting side, firm side of things. If you want to get a hold of Liddell, the best phone number is, I should have had Liddell give these out, but I'll do it real quick, is there's a couple phone numbers. You can go with 435-865-5866. Or 800-948-8030. Those are going to be the best way to get a hold of Liddell if you've got questions about this or want to set up some time to speak with him. And Lisa's got that up on the chat window as well. So if you didn't take it down while you were listening, you may be able to see it there. Our next tipster on the law side is my fellow attorney at KKOS Lawyers down in the Irvine, California office, working with Mark down there and holding down the fort when Mark's not there. It's Lee Chen. How are you, Lee?
Jerome, I am great. Thanks for having me on.
Hey, great to have you. I appreciate you taking the time. I know you're just as busy as I am, so glad you can take some time out of your day to give a legal tip here. Without further ado, why don't you go ahead and kind of introduce your tip?
Well, Jerome, this is kind of a tip that I get all the time in different varieties, and so I kind of wanted to put it all together and just talk about it has to do with litigation and avoidance and how you should be properly documenting your transactions when you're, you know, buying a house or, you know, you can use this these strategies anytime you're dealing with a creditor, anytime you're dealing with anyone involving a legal relationship. You should be properly documenting, you know, what is going on so that if it goes south, then, you know, you have to come into our office and say, you know, I got a dispute against this person or that person, that you properly have the backup to support your facts. You know, when you're in court, it's really not about who's right and wrong. It's about what you can prove. And so I wanted to talk about some of the things, you know, that I usually tell clients when they come into our office and say, well, this is my situation, and then I ask them, well, did you document this, and did you document that, and they say, well,
yeah.
No, and then I have to, you know, give them the news that, well, it's going to be a difficult, you know, case. So I wanted to talk about some of the specifics issues where I see when documentation really needs to be taken care of.
Yeah, and just real quick before you get into it, I think this is an excellent topic. I mean, we're a law firm that if you're going to be involved in litigation, we can absolutely help you. And especially Lee is an experienced litigator in our firm. But like you said, this tip is about avoiding litigation. And I, as an attorney, and even before I was an attorney, I was a huge fan of avoiding litigation when possible. So I really think these are steps that are important for people to take. They don't seem important until you're on the cusp of being sued or having to sue somebody. But at that point, there are things you're going to be really happy you did. So go ahead, Lee.
Absolutely. I mean, really, you know, the clients that I talk to, they don't realize how important it is until they have to call me and either have to, you know, have me defend them in a lawsuit or bring a lawsuit. And the first thing I'm going to ask is, you know, show me your documentation. How are you going to prove your case? So, you know, when you're in court, you know, the verbal, he said, she said, well, she told me this, you know, that's, those type of cases are going to make for a long, expensive dispute. And so what I really want when you come into my office and say, well, I want to sue or I'm being sued, is what type of hard documentary evidence do you have to prove your case? And what I want to talk about is, you know, how to do that, because the clients a lot of times say, well, you know, this person just told me this, but he wouldn't put it in writing. So how do I go about documenting something like that? So in general, you know, if it is an important part of the transaction, it should be documented. So, and one thing I would say before I get into the specifics types of cases is I usually prefer at least two different methods of documentation in terms of two different, whether it's email, whether it's fax, whether you you certify it. I like to have two different ways so that, you know, I always get, especially with attorneys, well, I didn't get this or you didn't send that to me. So I like having at least two different methods that you can track, that you can, you know, you have a record of sending in case that becomes an issue.
Right. Absolutely. So, I think that's big. I mean, the more sources of identification or confirmation that you have, the better. I mean, some people say, well, is an email good enough? Well, it might be, but an email and a, you know, a fax or something in the mail, you know, together is even better, obviously.
Again, it's all about what you, you know, proving your case, and the more you have, you know, the more convincing it's going to be. So, you know, usually we deal with a lot of real estate transactions, so I kind of want to focus on where these documentations can really help you in a real estate transaction.
Sure.
One area is, you know, when you give instructions to, you know, people that you hire, your agent, you know, your real estate agents, if you are a rehabber and you are giving instructions to your contractor, you know, I'm getting a whole lot of disputes between rehabbers and their contractors. And a lot of them, you know, would have been better cases had there been documentation during the process as to, you know, what needed to be done, when, and why. You know, I have one case dealing with an agent where my client, who's a rehabber, found out during escrow an important fact about a property that needed to be disclosed. And so this investor said, well, they called up the real estate agent and said, well, I just found this information out about the property. Make sure that the other side is told about it. And that was it. And sure enough, the real estate agent didn't follow up or for some reason didn't feel like it was something that needed to be told. And now I'm stuck in a dispute where they're saying, the buyer's saying, well, we never knew about it.
Yeah.
And so my question to my client is, well, did you send an email to your real estate agent or did you fax this instruction saying, make sure you disclose this? And the investor said no. And so, you know, we've gone through a mediation. We might be going through a lawsuit. And a lot of it probably could have been avoided had there just been an email or a fax or something that went to the real estate agent or to the other side that said, hey, I just found out this fact about the property. Here it is.
Yeah. Yeah. And in a lot of these situations, you may feel like you may be hesitant to ask for these things, or we had an oral conversation. I'm going to send you an email to confirm that. Please just, you know, send me an email back that says, yes, that's accurate, or, you know, I'm going to send you a letter to this effect, even though we had a conversation. You may feel like, gosh, I feel like a jerk, or I feel like I'm being difficult to deal with. But people who are experienced in business and in transactions are going to understand that, yeah, this protects all of us, so that we know that this conversation was had, or that this document was provided. I mean, I have a similar had a similar case where we were defending a real estate agent on an issue about, oh, did she know about soil issues, which on the property, which is a big deal here in southern Utah. Just about every house has some sort of settlement or soil issues. Well, there had been a soils report that was done, and our real estate agent had the email where she sent that soils report to the buyer. She represented the seller to the buyer's real estate agent. And so the buyer's real estate agent couldn't say that he never got it. But the buyer himself says that he never got it from his real estate agent. And the buyer's real estate agent, all he could say was in a deposition, well, yeah, I gave it to him. I printed it out and gave it to him. But the buyer was saying, no, I never got it. And he didn't have that email documentation that, yeah, here is when the time I sent it to you, and it was attached, and all of that. So sometimes an email can be better than handing somebody something in person, because you've got that documentation that at this time I actually sent you this.
Absolutely, Jeremy. And actually, you're reading my mind. You actually touched upon two of the other instances where we do want to make the disclosures confirm things in writing is when you make disclosures, okay?
Yeah.
When you buy real estate, you have to, you know, disclose certain things about the property. And my practice is whether you're giving the disclosures or you're receiving the disclosures, once it is made, you send out an email or something to disclose, hey, this will confirm that I sent you A, B, C, and D. Or if you're on the receiving side, this will confirm that you sent me A, B, C, and D. That way you have confirmation that it was sent, but also what specifically was sent. Because,
right.
You know, like in California, there is a whole host of different disclosures that you're supposed to be making, whether it's, you know, the condition of the property, whether it's termite, whether it's natural hazards, lead-based paint. And, so when you list out, you send out an email that lists out what you received and when you received it, you have a list of, you know, you're keeping track of what you got and when it was sent, so that if it becomes an issue, you pull it out and say, look, this is what you gave me and this is when you gave it to me.
Right. Absolutely.
So, and another thing that you mentioned was, you know, when you have a, come up with some oral agreement with the other side. You say, you know, for example, if you're a landlord-tenant and the landlord says, well, you know, you broke the window, I'll give you, $100 credit, off the rent if you fix the window. And if you're the tenant, you say, well, will you put that in writing? And the landlord says, well, you know, no, I'm, or if you're scared, you know, if you're not scared, but, reluctant to ask the landlord to do that because you don't want to be a pain. If the other side is not willing to confirm it, you confirm it. Okay,
right.
You send that email out and say, dear landlord, this will confirm our conversation today, whereas you said that you would credit $100 off my rent if I fixed that broken window myself.
Yeah.
And that is something, that's not just something that applies in the, real estate transactions or whatever. If you're fighting with a creditor, if you're fighting with the IRS, if you're fighting with a bank, with respect to, they're trying to say you didn't make a payment or something, you're trying to work out some sort of arrangement, and, the bank representative you're talking to tells you certain things, that's important to, where you're at, send them that fax. send them that confirming certified mail that says, on such and such a date, I talked to so-and-so, and this is what was discussed. So you have cemented that conversation in a written form.
Love it. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
So,
absolutely.
And I would just say, whenever you're talking to, you know, creditors, banks, IRS, you know, any possible, person, entity that, you know, there could be a legal issue, you want to keep a log of all of these conversations, pull out a piece of paper and just every time you make a call, especially if you're trying to negotiate a debt down with a bank or something, you know, you're going to be talking with different people.
Right.
You're going to want to, you know, keep a log of who you talk to, when you talk to with them, and so that if it becomes an issue, if you ever have to, lodge a complaint with a government authority, you know, the Attorney General's office or whoever regulates, you know, the person that you're talking to, or if you need, you know, to file a lawsuit, those written documentation, those written logs can be used as evidence.
Absolutely. I think that's especially big, and luckily we don't have as many clients going through this as we used to, or at least when I first started here 3 years ago. But with dealing with banks and lenders in foreclosure situations, you know, you'll talk to 20 different people when you call about a loan modification or, some sort of alternative to foreclosure. And so if you can log who you talk to and when and what they said, that's going to be really helpful in that sort of situation as well.
Yeah, and then if it's important to document, then that's when you write that extra email, send that extra fax, to them that says, hey, this is what your representative told me today.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, so those are the main issues that I wanted to hit upon in terms of documentation. Really, it is, litigation avoidance. It really is just CYA when you're doing this.
Yeah.
So, I just want to encourage the listeners to get in that practice. You know, if you're in a conversation or you're in a particular situation in a transaction where it's important, it could have potential legal consequences, you want that documented. Because if that ever becomes an issue, if you want to come into my office and, either file a lawsuit or defend a lawsuit, that's the first thing I'm going to ask you.
Yeah. When it comes to this kind of documentation, this is probably the one time in life it pays to be a hoarder. The more of this stuff you have, the better. So they won't make a show about you on A&E or anything like that. But if you're hoarding documentation like this and have a bunch of it, then you've got more ammo than the other person when it comes to litigation or the threat of litigation.
Yeah, especially, with everything stored electronically now, you can take pictures of it, you can scan it, it becomes a lot easier to do this if you, have that regular practice of doing so.
Makes sense, Lee. Well, I appreciate you coming on the show. I'm going to let you go, but before I let you go, because I don't want this to become just two kind of nerd attorneys talking about documentation, but it's really important. It absolutely is, and hopefully people are getting a fair amount out of our conversation. So why don't you let people know, I forgot to let Liddell do this, but let people know how they can get a hold of you.
Absolutely, Jerem. If you want to get a hold of me, you can just call our office. Number is 888-801-0010, or you can shoot me an email. My email is Lee, L-E-E, at kkoslawyers.com.
All right, Lee. Thanks a bunch.
Thanks, Jerem. It's great to be on.
Okay. Great to have you. All right. Well, that was Lee, and I appreciate Lee coming on and taking some time for maybe a little bit longer tip than he would normally give, but he was doing that to help me out so that I didn't have to fill the entire show by myself. But I think we've got a really an exciting and helpful topic for people. The people that listen to this podcast and this radio show are entrepreneurs. They're people in business for themselves. They've got ideas and products and services and ways to identify those products and services that are rights and property in and of themselves. And that's what we're going to help educate you on a little bit with this show and maybe give you some solutions or some ideas about what to do to protect those things. Really quickly, before I get into the meat of that, though, I didn't, and I wanted to get these on the show. The dates for Mark's Wealth Transformation Workshops this fall, just get these out there so you can be thinking about them. If you're going to be in any of these areas on these dates or want to travel to these areas on these dates and maybe get a tax write-off perhaps for that travel, for education about your business and how to maximize your business income and minimize taxes and be protected from a legal standpoint, these are wealth transformation workshops that are really a great idea. Mark's going to be in Philadelphia for the Wealth Transformation Workshop on September 24th. On October 18th, he'll be in Sacramento, California. On November 8th, Seattle, Washington. November 22nd, he's going to be close to his home in Orange County, California. And on December 13th in tropical Honolulu, Hawaii. So if you can make it to any of those events, they will be well worth your time, well worth your money. There's information and pricing in the newsletter. There's a link to that as well as on Mark's website, markjkohler.com. You could probably even get to it from kkoslawyers.com. I will be speaking this fall in locations in rural Utah, Logan and Vernal, Utah, Kanab and Richfield, as well as here in Cedar City and St. George. So I don't get to go to quite as exotic as locations as Mark does, but it will be fun nonetheless. I'm going to be talking more about estate and business planning for ranchers and farmers, as well as real estate professionals. We're going to get some continuing education credit for my speaking events. We'll have those dates nailed down a little bit better, but they will be mainly in November, and I think a couple in early December of this year. So keep those in mind if you're local here in Utah. I'll be making the circuit for those sorts of things. But I want to get, we've got about a half hour left in the show. I'm going to be going through, and I want you to stay with me. I want you to stay awake. I'm going to try to make this as interesting as possible. As Mark has said before, I've worked in radio before I got into law. I actually just interned at a radio station when I was in college, a sports talk radio station. So maybe I'd rather be talking about the upcoming NFL season or college football, but these are probably more important topics. So hopefully they're educational and they can maybe pique your interest to get some of these things done and protect your rights and your intellectual property. A lot of the people listening to this podcast or this show, like I said, are entrepreneurs. They're small business owners. Most of you listening to the show probably are. And you've got, whether you know it or not, you've got rights and property in something as simple as the name of your business. You want to be able to distinguish the good quality of your products and services from somebody who's maybe going to be a knockoff of and try to do the same thing you're doing or something similar under a similar name or in a similar way. That's where these tools of intellectual property can come in. Kind of the most simple one is, let's say you're doing business as a sole proprietor. You don't have a business entity in place. You can get, by filing with your state, a DBA, or a doing business as, where you can be just Jerem Bergeson doing business as XYZ Investments, or some name for your company. That DBA is going to provide some limited protection for the name that you're doing business under, for the name of your company. That limited protection is this. No one else, let's say I file that here in the state of Utah, and I've got a DBA for, let's just say it's Bergeson Enterprises, my last name. That means that no one else in the state of Utah can register a business name under that same name or anything really, really similar. They're not going to be able to go and set up a corporation called Bergeson Enterprises. They're not going to be able to set up an LLC with that name. They're not going to be able to get their own DBA in that name, or likely anything with Bergeson in it, if I've got a DBA. Now, what that doesn't mean is it doesn't mean that no one can do business in the state of Utah with that name. That doesn't necessarily mean that. The DBA doesn't provide you that sort of protection in and of itself. It just isn't. It's going to make it so that no one else can register a business in that name. You get the same protection if you actually register your business entity in that name. If it was Bergeson Enterprises, no one else in the state of Utah would be able to register an LLC or a DBA or a corporation with that same name. So that is really, you're going to get some protection for the name of your business by doing that. But that's really about it when it comes to filing a DBA or putting the name of your company, registering the name of your company. So that's one level of kind of a really informal level of protection for your intellectual property. Kind of the next step up, and I'm gonna go up in terms of how complex or difficult it is to obtain these various means of intellectual property protection. The next kind of step up, something that's fairly, relatively easy to obtain, is a copyright. People sometimes get confused about, well, what is a copyright? Well, copyright's just a form of protection that's provided by the laws of the U.S. It's a federal, it's not a state law thing, it's a federal law issue. To authors, so it provides protection to the authors of original works of authorship. That includes literary, dramatic, musical, artistic, and other creative works. A copyright holder can then prevent others from copying, performing, or otherwise using the work without their consent. People ask the question, the next kind of follow-up question is, well, what's copyrightable? I don't even know if that's a word, but what can be copyrighted and what can't? Here's just kind of a general list of things that can be copyrighted. Literary works, musical works, including any accompanying words, so lyrics, dramatic works, including any accompanying music, pantomimes and choreographic works. So for those of you who think, you know, I'm going to be on like America's Best Dance Crew or whatever that show was, because I've got these moves that I've choreographed, you can copyright those. Like Napoleon Dynamite in the moves he has at the end of the Napoleon Dynamite movie, you know, they could copyright. The film itself is copyrighted, Napoleon Dynamite, but they could actually copyright Napoleon's moves at the student assembly there at the end of the movie, or pantomimes. I don't know why you would want to copyright a pantomime. If it was just really awesome, I guess you could. Pictorial, graphic, and sculptural works can be copyrighted. So a photograph, a graph or a sculpture, motion pictures or other audiovisual works, sound recordings, architectural plans, drawings, and actual buildings. What's important is that they have to be in some sort of tangible form. They can't just be words that you say. It has to be more than an idea. It has to be the term is fixed in a tangible medium or a tangible form of expression. It means the work has to be written or otherwise recorded. Again, the copyright doesn't protect an idea or a plan. It protects the expression of that idea or plan. So, you know, magazine copy is copyrightable. Internet, you know, website content can be copied. Photographs can be copyrighted. Here at the law firm, the documents that we provide for doing business entity setups or estate plan work, that's copyrighted by the firm. The other thing is that copyrightable works have to be original. You can't copy them, obviously, from someone else. And they have to at least contain a minimal level of creativity on the part of the author. Things like well-known phrases and lists of names or ingredients in and of themselves aren't copyrightable. But if they're organized or expressed in an original manner, then a copyright's going to protect the organization or expression of those ideas. Although not the actual facts or lists contained, so I can't copyright a recipe for a certain dish, that I make. But if I have a cookbook that organizes a bunch of recipes into one place, then that the expression in that cookbook is copyrightable. In general, as far as who can hold a copyright, only the creator or the author of the original work can register a copyright. However, if the author prepared the work within the scope of their employment, or if the work falls into other special categories and was specially ordered or commissioned by someone else, then the work is considered what's called a work made for hire. In that case, the employer or the commissioning party is considered to be the owner of the copyright. So, you know, for example, I draft documents here for the law firm, but I'm an employee of the law firm. So when I draft these documents and they've got a copyright on them, I'm not the owner of that copyright. KKOS Lawyers is. My employer is the owner of that copyright. And just ownership of a book, people think, well, I've got a copyright because I own a copy of, you know, some literary work. No, you're not the author. You just own a copy of someone else's copyrighted work. Something interesting, minors can claim copyright. So if your kid has, you know, done a finger painting and you've got it on your fridge and it's spectacular and you want to sell copies of it, you're not the author of that work, so you can't copyright it, but your four-year-old daughter who did the awesome finger painting, she can do that. She can copyright. The copyright can be hers in that painting. Obtaining copyright protection, there's a lot of kind of confusion about, well, how do I obtain this copyright protection? Do I have to register my copyright? How do I do that? It's really frequently misunderstood, but a copyright's secured automatically when a work is created. So when you write down on a piece of paper a poem, your haiku about the upcoming NFL season or something like that, you have that work is copyrighted. It's created when it's fixed into a book, a tape, an electronic medium for the first time. You know, a song can be fixed in sheet music, or it can be a digital tape or a CD or both. This is important too. The work doesn't have to be published. It doesn't have to be registered. You don't have to take any action at all with the U.S. Copyright Office in order to have the copyright. Now, there are reasons to do that. There are reasons to register the copyright, but you have rights in what you create and what you write down or, you know, record or put into that fixed, tangible medium, even without recording anything with the U.S. Copyright Office. There are, however, advantages to going ahead and registering the copyright. One is that it establishes a public record of the copyright holder's ownership. Two, it enables copyright holders to sue infringers in federal court instead of state court, which can be easier. And federal courts are much more used to doing copyright actions than state courts. If the registration is made before or within 5 years of publication, then that registration establishes sufficient evidence in court concerning the validity of the copyright and the facts stated in the copyright certificate. If the registration is made within 3 months of publication of the work, so if it is published, or at any time prior to an infringement of the work, then the copyright owner is entitled to seek statutory damages. There's actually damages for copyright infringement that are in the U.S. Code if you have registered your copyright. So you can get statutory damages and attorney's fees when you sue in federal court. Without any sort of registration, you can still sue when someone infringes your copyright. But you're only going to get an award of actual damages, so what that infringement actually cost you. If they infringed and it didn't cost you anything, then, you know, if it didn't cause you any damage, then you're not going to get any damages, and you're not going to get any attorney's fees paid either in most cases. Finally, registration allows the copyright owner to record the registration with U.S. Customs to protect against the importation of infringing copies into the U.S. So if somebody's knocking off your stuff in Mexico or Brazil or Australia or Japan or China and trying to get it into the States, having your copyright registered is going to be a lot of help. You know, what does the copyright protect? Well, it gives you, as the copyright owner, the right to reproduce the work, so you can make copies and give them away or sell them or whatever you want to do. You can prepare derivative works that are based on the original work, so perhaps a sequel to your original story. You could do that. You can distribute copies of the work to the public. You can perform the work publicly if it's that choreographed thing else like that. You can display that work publicly. You can display it or perform it, and you can perform it publicly by means of a digital audio transmission or video transmission as well. So how long does copyright protection last? Well, for anything created after January 1st, 1978, which is a few months before I was born, so we're going to say everything that we're talking about was created after that date, copyright protection is going to endure for the life of the author. So if it's your work, for as long as you're alive, plus an additional 70 years. So that could be a long time. In the case of your four-year-old daughter's painting, it could be 150 years. If the work was produced by two people and it's a joint work, then it's going to last for 70 years after the last surviving author's death. For anonymous works and works made for hire, so you know, for the stuff that's copyrighted that I do for KKOS, the copyright's 95 years from the year of first publication, or 120 years from the year of creation, whichever expires first. There are some limits on copyright protection. One of them is the doctrine of fair use. A lot of people have heard that. Fair use allows others to use portions of the copyrighted works for purposes such as reviews, commentary, news, and scholarship. Fair use, a lot of times, is parody is a fair use. Saturday Night Live parodies somebody's book or a show. They can use actual clips of that show or of the president's speech or something like that in order to comment on it and parody it. That's fair use. There are items that are not copyrightable: titles, names, common facts, and ideas. You can't copyright those sorts of things. And works that are in the public domain can be used by anyone. That includes works with expired copyrights. So, you know, things that, you know, movies and sound recordings from the early 20th century, you know, the authors of those have been gone for quite a while, and there are some of those things that are coming into the public domain because the copyright has expired. What do you do if someone is, you've registered a copyright, or maybe you didn't even register it, but you just have something that you've distributed that you created? What do you do if you think someone may be copying you or infringing on your copyright? You need to bring a suit for copyright infringement. If you've registered it, then it needs to be brought in federal court. In general, you've got 3 years from the most recent infringement to sue. A defendant in a copyright action can you know, claim that they created their defenses, or, well, I created the work independently, or I just copied sections of the work that aren't copyrightable, such as facts or news. A defendant can claim he or she's making fair use of the work, which we talked about, criticism, comment, parody, news, research, and scholarship. The court's going to look at a lot of factors, including whether the use was for profit. If it was for profit, it's more likely to be an infringement. How much of the work was copied, and the economic effect. Having the little circle C symbol isn't necessary, necessarily, to copyright your work, something that you've written or that you've recorded. You don't have to have the little copyright symbol in order to have some copyright works. And you don't have to have registered your copyright with the Copyright Office in order to use that circle C. So you can put that on things. So you don't have to do it. But it's good practice to do so, and the reason is it's going to put people on notice that your work is copyrighted, and it's going to weaken any defense somebody may have of innocent infringement, which is, oh, I didn't know that was copyrighted. The other nice thing about registering your copyright is that the U.S. has copyright relations with 100 countries around the world, so as a result, your U.S. copyright is likely to be recognized and honored in most other industrialized countries. So that's copyright. And so there's a lot of reasons to register a copyright. we can help. Our law firm does help people with copyrights. I am kind of the intellectual property attorney at the law firm here, so most of those inquiries would come to me. So if you have a question or something that you want to talk to me about doing a copyright, you can get a hold of me. I would be the person to talk to. Quite frankly, in most cases, a copyright is something that most people can handle themselves, getting it registered with the U.S. Copyright Office. You go to copyright.gov, and they will walk you through the process. You'll have to submit an example of what you want to copyright. They will then register the copyright, and you'll get a little registration certificate. It's not terribly expensive. It's not terribly complex. But I have had clients who don't want to take the time, or they're just not inclined that way, and I've helped them with that. And that's not a problem. We can help you with that. But I would encourage just about everybody to try to take a look at doing the copyright themselves before they get to us. So that's copyrights. The next form of intellectual property protection is a trademark. And a trademark is really anything that's used or intended to be used to identify the goods of one manufacturer from the goods of another. It's like basically a brand name: Coca-Cola, Pepsi, Nike. Those are trademarks, not copyrights. Trademarks are important because they allow companies to establish their product's reputation without having to worry that some sort of inferior product is going to diminish their reputation in the marketplace or their profit. Trademarks include words, names, symbols, logos, anything like that identifies your product. That's going to be a trademark. The other word that kind of goes with trademark is service mark. You'll hear that used as well. Service mark is really just a trademark that identifies a service. So if your company doesn't produce cola or sneakers, but instead offers some sort of service, real estate investing education or something like that, you can trademark the name of your company or the name of your service. That's called a service mark. You won't hear that term as often as you'll hear trademark, and while I'm talking about it, I'm going to use trademark in place of service mark. So when I say trademark, I'm talking about a trademark for products or goods and services as well, just to kind of keep that clear. In order to establish trademark rights, you have to do one of two things. You have to actually either use that trademark in commerce in connection with your goods or services, or you have to file a proper application to register the trademark with the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, and I'll be calling that the USPTO. And then you have to use the trademark in commerce within a prescribed period of time after you do the application. Registering with the USPTO is not it's not necessary to establish trademark rights. However, it's even more important with a trademark than it is with a copyright that you actually register the trademark. Let me go through some of the benefits of actually registering your trademark. One, it serves as constructive notice to the public of your ownership of the trademark. That's big. It establishes a legal presumption, so the presumption is going to be in your favor, of your ownership of the mark and your exclusive right to use the trademark nationwide, or in connection with the goods and services listed in the registration. It'll allow you to bring an action concerning the trademark in federal court, which again is an advantage. It can be used as the basis to obtain registration of the trademark in foreign countries. If you don't have it registered in the U.S., that's not going to be able to be registered in other countries, and it can be filed again with U.S. Customs to prevent the importation of infringing foreign goods, which is, I think, even more important in the trademark realm than it is in the copyright realm. It's going to allow you to use the Circle R registered trademark symbol. If you're not registering your trademark or you haven't yet, but you want to let people know that that is your trademark and you're identifying it as such, you can put the little symbol or the letters TM after the trademark. But you can't do the Circle R for a registered trademark until you've actually not just filed the application with the USPTO, but actually had it had it approved and registered by the USPTO. You're going to want to, so if you've got a product or a service or a name or a logo for your company or for your business or your products that you want to trademark, you need to do a search and at least go on the internet and find, is someone else already using that name? Somebody already using a logo that looks just like mine? Because if they are and they're using it in a for a product or a service that's pretty similar to yours, you're not going to be able to get a registered trademark if there's going to be a quote-unquote likelihood of confusion between your mark and the already registered mark. Even if a mark's not registered, there may be an infringement problem if somebody else is using that mark in commerce, even if they don't have it registered yet. That's not to say you can't use a name someone else already has. The example I always use is there is Delta Faucets to Airlines. Those trademarks are allowed to peacefully coexist because one is an airline and one are faucets and sinks. They're not similar products. So Delta Faucets and Delta Airlines are allowed to coexist. There are some obviously legal requirements for registering your trademark, and I just have to get this in. I'm running short on time, which is glad. I wasn't sure I was going to be able to fill all the time, but looks like I will. I wouldn't suggest going through the trademark application process by yourself without legal representation. Whether from us, I do our trademark applications here at KKOS Lawyers, or with someone else. There are a few reasons for that. The decision of whether your name or logo can be trademarked is much more difficult than whether something can be copyrighted. Your name has to be something that doesn't just describe what you do. If you provide real estate investment services, you can't trademark the name Real Estate Investment Services, Inc., because that just describes what you already do. You're going to need someone to search the trademark database to look for already conflicting marks and to do a search on the internet for something that may conflict with what you already have. You're going to have to provide or specimens of use of your trademark that comply with USPTO regulations. For products, that means your trademark is going to have to be on the product itself or on the packaging for the product. For a service, it means you're going to have to be using that name to advertise your service, either on the internet, that's usually the easiest way, or through flyers or posters where that name or logo is actually being used to identify your products or services. It's a bit of a legal minefield. I learn new things about trademark registrations and applications every time I do one. So it's well worth your time and well worth the extra money. In this case, as opposed to copyrights, to have an attorney file your trademark application for you and to look into whether it can even be registered. It's not a quick process. We're dealing with the federal government here, after all. Once you file your application, you're not going to hear from the USPTO for generally 3 to 4 months. If things go smoothly and they don't need any additional information, or they're not going to, or they don't want to deny your registration for some reason, then it'll register usually within 6 to 8 months. If they're requesting additional information, or they don't like the product or service description you gave them, or they think that your trademark conflicts with an already registered mark, it can take much, much longer, a year or longer, to get everything straightened out. So the most common reasons, I'm going to get at these real quick and then finish. The most common reasons that a trademark application is denied are, one, that the proposed trademark is either merely descriptive or deceptively misdescriptive of the applicant's good or services. Examples of this would be descriptive trademarks, which could be refused, including like things like medical guide for a website that features medical guides, denim for jeans, or spicy sauce for salsa. Those are not going to be trademarkable. The other one is if the proposed trademark resembles a mark, closely resembles a mark already registered with the USPTO, so that use of the applicants would likely cause confusion, mistake, or deception. So if that's the case, there are other reasons, much more obscure, but those are going to be the main reasons that a trademark application would be denied. Once you get your trademark, you have to enforce it. You have to be on the lookout for people that are infringing on the trademark. If they are infringing, you've got to send them cease and desist letters. Because if people trample on your mark, you're going to lose that mark if you're just allowing people to trample on it. So you've got to be vigilant about that. You're going to have to renew your trademark within the fifth year after you get it. And then a 10-year mark, and then every 10 years thereafter. So that's kind of the lay of the land for trademarks. If you want to get a hold of me about any of that stuff, I was going to get into patents, but I couldn't. Our number here is 435-586-9366. My name's, my email address is jerem@kkoslawyers.com. Please feel free to contact me. It's been a pleasure filling in for Mark. Have a great day.
Thanks for listening to another hour of refreshing strategies to better live your American dream.
Don't forget to get your free copy of Mark and Matt's ebooks and sign up for their weekly free newsletter with important tax deadlines and articles at refreshyourwealth.com.